WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Daniel Harris set out to write an anti-memoir, a book that would satirize the vogue for memoirs and probe the typical banalities of daily life. But he realized that little about his life is typical. He describes himself as an effete homosexual who spends 6 days of the week reading and writing, who lounges around for most of his waking hours in a house robe and pajamas, and who ekes out a subsistence living. His book turned into an unconventional memoir in which, as he puts it, he examines how his wardrobe and sex life have evolved, how his relationship to books has changed, and how he cannot lie with the same poetic license that made his childhood fibs so colorful. The book is called A Memoir of No One in Particular. I asked Daniel Harris to do a short reading and to introduce it for us.
My father was a therapist, a very liberal Jewish therapist. My mother was a disaffected Baptist director of a large daycare center. So they were both involved in social service organizations. And so they instilled in me really intensely democratic principles that were somehow at odds with my homosexuality. And that's what this passage is about. My parents' belief in the importance of social service organizations, along with the radicalism of the counterculture, fostered in me a fiercely egalitarian commitment to helping the poor and fighting for minority rights. My politics, however, simply did not jibe with an aspect of my life that pulled me in exactly the opposite direction, my homosexuality. I grew up taunted by the very people I now hope to serve, the sons of Wisconsin farmers, gang members in Buffalo, and rednecks in Appalachia, bigots whose scorn I met halfway with my own contempt, a self-protective superciliousness I cultivated by embracing the very things my peers despised, most notably literature and art. I became a snob, an elitist, a dandy who, during one mercifully brief period in early adolescence, adopted a cane, and during a much longer period, in fact for the rest of my life, a faint British accent. But at the same time that I was looking down my nose at the unwashed masses, I was kissing their children, malnourished six-year-olds who came to the daycare center starving, with black eyes, distended bellies, and rotten teeth. Early in my adolescence, I was torn between the political lessons of equality that were a key part of my moral education and my survival tactics as an effeminate teenager, my use of books, culture, and an air of sophistication to project the kind of power my heterosexual schoolmates found on the basketball court and the football field.
You say in your book that that as a kid you used to listen to tapes of your voice and kind of ran the self-imposed language lab. What did you hear when you listened back to your voice when you were young?
I'm not sure that I really remember what I heard. We moved from Wisconsin, a small town in Wisconsin, to Asheville, North Carolina. And we had visited several times before we moved down there, and I got one I heard the Appalachian accent, which is not one of these luscious, deep southern brogues. So I brought with me a tape of all of the vowel sounds and the consonants and a few key sentences that I played back, and so that I would not get a southern accent. And I was just determined not to get a southern accent. And I did succeed. But what I have created is really artificial, as one can tell, a very artificial kind of delivery. And I do not have a southern accent. My accent is not like my parents. So where did it come from? And I think that the answer is that it came from popular culture, which is one of the ways that homosexuals did create their sensibility and their demeanor, is by imitating the false Brahmins of old Hollywood films, who do speak, oddly enough, even though they live in California and were born in the Bronx, they all speak with a refined British accent. And I adopted this refined British accent straight off of the silver screen.
You devote a chapter of your memoir to lying. What kinds of things did you once lie about?
Well, when I was a child, I took real poetic license and lied in very extravagant ways. In fact, one of the most embarrassing lies I made was it started in I don't know what grade. I was very young, and other kids were getting glasses, and my vision was perfect. Absolutely perfect. There was nothing I could do. So I decided I would feign that I failed the eye exam. Well, I did fail the first eye exam. I was taken to a specialist. I gave such erratic, such inconsistent responses that I was taken to yet another optometrist, and finally was taken out of state to a specialist who exposed me and said, "You're lying." And I was trying to do, at first all I wanted was glasses, but it acquired a kind of momentum because I was so thrilled by being this dying Camille character with a tragic illness and that I would be blinded by the time I was 15. So it was really an attempt to create for myself, which is, I think, what this book is about, an alternative identity, an identity I did not have. But I think that really, through lying, you create a sort of mobility to get out of circumstances that you shouldn't be in or you don't want to be in.
You spend most days working home alone.
Right.
Writing, reading. And the book that you've just written is a book all about yourself. Mm-hmm. Because it's a memoir that details the objects and habits of your daily life. So what do you do to prevent an unhealthy level of self-absorption?
It's true. This book is really navel-gazing, taken to a unnatural extreme. But who says that my life is not pathologically self-absorbed? I am pathologically self-absorbed. And the one thing that I feel is that I am somebody, as I've mentioned, who considers himself no one in particular. I was self-created. I did not have, myself did not come out of my religion or my family or the community I lived in. It doesn't come out of my job. All of the things in my life, all of the structure in my life is self-imposed. I have created this vast edifice of habits that from getting up in the morning to when I go to the gym in the afternoon to what I do at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And it is really an attempt to create a structure in a life that has no structure whatsoever. And I could easily simply put down my pen and never pick it up again. And I can assure you nobody would make too many complaints about me having done that. So it's all really my own initiative, this life. It's extremely... it's very taxing, and one of the things that I find about my the solitary nature of my life is that because it is the creation of this edifice of habits, the habits become very self-punishing, and I really am a taskmaster in fulfilling them. If I do not go to the gym in the afternoon, I am miserable that evening. So there, and if I gain 2 or 3 pounds, I'm miserable about it. So that these habits really have acquire a life of their own in a life that emerges out of a kind of vacuum, as mine does.
Your memoir ends with you saying that you've retreated to a somewhat tragic view of life. In what sense?
I think that I was a child... I was a bright kid, and I got, you know, I was always in the 99.9 percentile of all of the tests, and I was told I could be anything I wanted to be. My father was a psychologist who really was very heavily influenced by the human potential movement and the notion that one can achieve anything. And as I have grown older, I've realized how false that promise is, that... that I cannot, for instance, I have never achieved my aspirations of securing a readership for my writing. I have no control over these things. The book is partly a rediscovery of these absolutes in a culture that purveys myths about the omnipotence of the individual.
So how old are you?
I am now 44. When I finished the book, I was 43. Mm-hmm. I used to have a stage age, though. Yes, I did used to cut years off of my life, especially, you know, not necessarily with men, but with editors. That's how oddly ambitious I was, because it was very, very difficult for me to relinquish the myth of precocity that haunts contemporary culture, that I think is really, I've learned, is a kind of marketing ploy, an attempt to create the illusion that a publisher is publishing the latest writer, the writer of the future. And as I've become older and older and never qualified for the writer of the future, I have become very, very skeptical about the notion of precocity and precocious writers. I think that writers have, the apprenticeship for a writer is 10 or 20 years. I don't think writers become good writers in their 20s.
So you have to find a way of being comfortable with the fact that you're not the young next hot thing.
That's right. I'm an old hot thing. I'm the oldest living hottish thing.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Daniel Harris is the author of A Memoir of No One in Particular. This is Fresh Air.